Hello and welcome to Eclectic Waffle, the podcast with one theme only: interesting conversations with interesting people about interesting things. I'm your host, Tom, and it's very nice to have you here. It's Father's Day here in the UK today, so happy Father's Day to those of you who are fathers, and happy Father's Day to those of you thinking about your father, and in particular to those of us whose father has died. I think about Dad every day, but I feel it particularly keenly on this day, as I know my sister does. And it's a time to reflect and cherish my memories of Dad. One of the things that we had in common was a love of snooker. In fact, he helped inspire that in me. He watched snooker regularly. I know he'd played a bit when he was a younger man. And we'd sit down and watch quite a lot of it together. And I didn't stay up for the Dennis Taylor, Steve Davis black ball final in 1985. But the next morning, Dad said, "You'll never guess what happened." And told me all about it. So when I look now at the footage of that amazing final frame, I feel like I watched it live at the time, even though I didn't. I made myself a little snooker table as a kid. We had a Lego set, and there was a thin square of green Lego, which was designed to look like a lawn. This is quite appropriate, actually, because snooker tables are green, because they evolved from lawn games. Interesting little fact if you didn't know that. So I got this plastic piece of Lego, and I added Lego bricks, and they were my bumpers, and I used marbles and a stick, and I had a little mini snooker table. And one day Dad came back from work, and he said they had been very impressed by my industry and ingenuity in making myself a snooker table. And so he'd bought me one. It was also very much a mini table that you just put on top of the kitchen table. And the balls were barely any bigger than marbles, but they were plastic and there was little cues. And so that was my table. And we played on that a bit. And then we bought a bigger table, probably, I think, about 5 foot one, I expect. 5 or 6 foot, maybe. And that could go in the living room. And that then was really quite like a proper game of snooker on a smaller scale. And I came to really like pool from going to my local pub. And just really enjoy all kinds of billiards. But last year I realised that I actually loved all kinds of billiards, and that it made no sense not to play more regularly. So I joined my local snooker and pool club and went along. My first day there, I was useless. American pool tables are 9 foot by 4.5 foot. Very big pockets, very big balls. It's a myth that American pool is easier than other kinds of billiards. But what is easier is potting a few balls in a row. And yet I was terrible, and I was missing the object ball constantly. Not just missing the pot, but missing the ball altogether. But I stuck at it, and not that long afterwards, I potted 5 balls in a row on a snooker table. So the difference in standard after just a few weeks really was enormous. And it's teaching me a lot of valuable lessons about life. First of all, it is so easy to give up, to convince oneself that one's no good. And this isn't always because of a pessimistic attitude, and it's not always because of depression. It's not always because of laziness. I think people sometimes sincerely believe that something's not possible, and then it seems rational to stop. And I think a lot of people who play pool but love watching snooker don't play snooker because they just think they'll never be any good at it at all. But the thing about snooker, of course, is that if you're just slightly out by a small margin when you approach the cue ball, by the time it gets to the other end of the table, that small miss is going to look like a massive miss. because of basic geometry. And if you hit the balls appreciably too hard, it doesn't just mean that you'll miss, but it changes the way the cue ball reacts. And if your stance is wrong, and most people's stance is wrong when they start playing, everything's going to be hideously wrong. And so people draw the wrong conclusion that they've got no ability and they're never going to have any ability. Whereas actually very, very small adjustments can make a massive difference, as does practice. So I would just say to you, please, 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 if you like snooker but think that it's impossible, don't think that. That's a mistake. Another misapprehension I was under for years was that I had bad eyesight. My eyesight is corrected. I wear contact lenses. And a couple of times my optician had told me I had really good eyesight. And eventually I said, so what do you mean by that? I mean, I can't possibly have good eyesight. That's why I have to wear contact lenses. And they explained to me that actually I wear contact lenses because I'm out of focus. But my eyes are the equivalent of a high-tech camera that can see more pixels. So yes, I'm out of focus, but when that's corrected, my eyesight's brilliant. And in fact, it is actually better than 20/20. That would explain why when I play snooker, I can sometimes look like a hustler, because I'll make a very, very long pot and then miss something that looks really easy. And it's because, as a result of having such good eyesight, a long pot is no harder for me than a short pot. But all pots are still really quite hard, and so I'm very hit and miss as to whether I make them or not. But what a shame it would have been to just think that my eyesight was going to go as I get into my 40s and maybe shouldn't think about snooker, because it turns out that actually I have superb eyesight, and that's going to be a massive, massive advantage. It's the first thing my snooker coach asked me, what's your eyesight like? I also have really enjoyed playing because the club is a great place, and I've met some really, really interesting people, including my coach, and quite a diverse range of people too. And that's a really good thing. It's one of the best things about taking up a hobby is you'll meet people who you'd never meet otherwise. People of different ages, people of different backgrounds, and that is a really, really good way of living a life well lived. There's also friends I've made as a result of joining the snooker club because of places I go before and after, places I go to eat. I've made some great friends from doing that. So just taking up this hobby, which I'd really intended to be largely solitary, I thought I'd just go and play by myself and kill some time and, you know, enjoy doing it, has ended up being very, very sociable, because actually I also have brought existing friends along to the club and played with them. But it spawned a number of other interests as well. I never thought I'd be interested in wood. I think I've talked about this a little bit when I talked about the guitars in an earlier episode. Snooker cues are largely made from ash, sometimes from maple. And pool cues are largely made from maple. Although the butts of the cues are made from different material, like ebony. And in the case of pool cues, they're often very exotic woods. And pool cues tend to be quite elaborate and often have these really intricate patterns on them, and sometimes they get very expensive just for that reason. And in fact, there is a tradition in pool of cues that are known as Sneaky Pete's, and a Sneaky Pete pool cue, which is named after a famous pool hustler, a Sneaky Pete pool cue is one that looks very basic because the design's very simple, but which is actually very high quality. Personally, that's my favourite kind of style. I admire bling on pool cues, but I like quite a simple style, probably influenced by first getting into billiards through watching snooker, where snooker cues are very beautiful, but they tend to have quite simple designs. And my gosh, hours can go by when I read about all these different cue makers. I spent a long, long time researching getting my snooker cue, because snooker cues seem to last for a player, ideally, their whole career. Stephen Hendry won all seven of his world titles in snooker with the same cue, a cue which all his friends in snooker thought was laughably bad. But when that very simple cue broke, he was told that baggage handlers had broke it. He said that his first response was, "That's my career over." This is something very different to tennis. A tennis player will use several different rackets during a match. The string tension goes, and so they go and pick out another one. It's a big deal when a tennis player changes the brand and model of racket that he uses, but physically changing it to another replica of the same one during a match is no problem at all. In snooker, that's not the same, because of wood. Wood reacts in different ways, and it's very, very hard to know how you're going to handle a new cue. There's a quality in pull cues known as low deflection, the idea being that that the cue throws the cue ball off far less than a normal cue does. The problem with that, though, is if you've got used to one cue and learned almost subconsciously sometimes to adjust for the way the cue throws the cue ball off, then you can be in difficulty. So I researched high and low when I got my cue, sent two of them back, and the one I've alighted on is really good, and whatever faults I have on a snooker table are not the fault of my excellent cue. It's very, very striking just how different the sports are. I'm afraid that I enjoy more than one, and so I can't throw all my efforts into getting good at one of them, because I wouldn't be happy only playing one of them. Pool and snooker are really quite profoundly different. American pool is very different from English pool. The big difference in English pool is that because it's often played in pubs and you want to be able to get the cue ball back, the cue ball is actually smaller than the object balls. So you'll see red and yellow balls and one black ball. They're all the same size, and then the cue ball is noticeably smaller. Now, yes, the players have to learn to adjust to that, and it's the same for everybody, but it does make the physics all wrong. You'll try and play quite significant follow-through on the cue ball, and it will actually bounce back off the object ball because it's smaller. That's basic physics. You learn a lot about physics and geometry in a practical sense when you play billiard games. Pool has, if it's American pool, has much bigger pockets, and that means that it's easier to pot three or four balls in a row. But of course, it also means that it's easier for the cue ball to be potted when it shouldn't be. And if something's easy or hard for you, then the same conditions apply to your opponent. That's another fascinating thing about these sports, that you are absolutely by yourself when you're at the table, and your opponent can't really, unless they start screaming and shouting at you, which they're not supposed to, your opponent can't really influence what you do. And yet you're still having to respond to what they've done. They will leave the table, and you will face the balls arranged as they have been by your opponent. Although, of course, if you get on a good run in pool, particularly in one of the matches where the winner carries on breaking, then you may stay at the table and your opponent be completely helpless to do anything whatsoever. So yes, pool and snooker are really quite different, and I find even the way that I approach the table and strike the ball and stroke with my cue is really different. You actually do want a slightly looser style in pool because you want to be able to move the cue ball around, and physical power is much more of a factor than it is in snooker. That's probably the only other thing going for me. I've naturally got very good cue power, good eyesight, good cue power, and nothing else going for me at all, really, other than energy and interest and a willingness to listen to my coach and to read up on things. These are the only sports I like which take a long time. I don't like any other slow sport. Golf leaves me completely cold. I like the idea of cricket. I like driving past a village game of cricket during the summer. I think it's a wonderful sight. And actually, I enjoyed playing cricket at college. I was friends with the captain, and he persuaded me to play. We were a small college, so I could get in the team. I was an all-rounder. I could neither bat nor bowl. But I had a very enjoyable summer playing cricket. But no, long, drawn-out sports just don't do anything for me. So why is it different with billiards? I'm using billiards as the overarching term for all kind of table cue sports. Well, because it's mesmerising and hypnotic. It's astonishing how the time will fly when I sit down and watch a snooker match or a pool match. And every frame is different. Yes, you have to take similar skills into every match and every frame. Although in a good snooker match, you might be doing different things to greater and lesser extents at different times. Potting may be at a premium in one frame, and then in another, it's your ability to get out of snookers, and then in another, it's your ability to put your opponent in a difficult position by snookering them. But every time you come to the table, the balls are arranged in a different pattern. And those different patterns mean that it's an almost infinitely variable sport and an enormously enjoyable one to play and to watch. David Attenborough is primarily famous for his wonderful wildlife documentaries. But my gosh, wasn't he clever to realise that the age of colour television, when he was a television commissioner at the BBC, that the age of colour television meant we could have a new age of snooker. This working man's club game, not really particularly prominent, was absolutely perfect for the screen. The whole table could fit into one shot, so you can see the whole thing in one go on your screen. And lo and behold, people were mesmerised. It helped enormously that the players were tremendously charismatic and different. How different Steve Davis was to Alex Higgins, who was different to Jimmy White, who was different to Bill Werbenick, who was different to his fellow Canadian Kirk Stevens, who was different to their fellow Canadian Cliff Thorburn. We have legends. We have the legend that is Joe Davis, who won the World Championship 20 times and wrote a brilliant book called How I Play Snooker, which was picked up by a young Steve Davis, same spelling, no relation, and he and his dad worked through it and worked their way through to 6 world titles in the modern era. It can be hypnotic, it can be peaceful, and then in the clutch moments it becomes unbelievably exciting. When the pressure's on, a player can have to make a shot which they would absolutely make 100 times out of 100 in a training session. But as their arm shakes, and as their whole body shakes, and as their eyes blur, and they get down to the table when they know millions of people are watching, and a great deal of money, and more importantly, the pride that will come from winning a title are on the line, then they have to deliver. It's horrific for people when they miss an easy shot. The dear, dear, recently departed Willie Thorne missed a blue, missed the blue ball when he was closing in on a big title. And given his ability as a snooker player, had he won that match, maybe the floodgates would have opened and he'd have won many more titles. And it's a shame in a way that he's so well remembered for that rather than the fact that he made a record number of maximum breaks. And it's a sport that both sexes can enjoy. The women are very much closing in on the men now in terms of absolute standards. Rhianne Evans is doing very well, does very well in the qualifying stages and the early stages of the World Championship. I think that some women are going to go over the top soon and we'll see them making the Crucible stage and the latter stages of big snooker tournaments. It might be different in pool, where physical strength is a factor, because the break is much more important than it is in snooker. But you go to snooker clubs now, certainly the one I go to, and you see lots of women and girls, and I wouldn't hesitate to take a young female relative to the snooker hall. It's no longer a forbidding, unwelcoming place. It's a great sport, a great set of sports. Oh, billiards as well. Got to mention three ball billiards. A whole new set of skills, largely about the geometry. And indeed, you can watch Caron billiards or three cushion billiards, and you'll notice something about the table, which is that it has no pockets. Tables don't actually need pockets in order to have a really good game of billiards. So this collection of sports is wonderful to watch, wonderful to play. I'm learning about Cinque Birilli, which is three cushion billiards with five little skittles in the middle of the table, which you both have to try and knock down and avoid in different contexts. And I'm really enjoying playing, and I'm watching my development, particularly in pool, and feeling really pleased with that. But as I do it, I feel close to my dad and feel like I'm honouring my father. And I want to honour him by getting as good as I can at this. And every time I play, that will very much be with me. When you have someone you love and you can find a point of attachment, it might be a sport, it might be music, it might be going for walks in the countryside. Could be lots of things. Could be learning how to do up and restore cars. Could be woodwork. Could just be that you enjoy going out, having a few drinks. When you find these points of attachment, cherish them. Because it's a way to bring people together, and that's something that we all need to do in every sphere of our lives. We need to do it as a world, we need to do it as a country, we need to do it in our communities, the places where we live. And it's most important that we do it with people whom we love, that when we find a shared interest, we really, really enjoy that. And where you can spark an interest in someone else, that is such a worthwhile thing to do. It'll make you feel good about yourself to bestow this gift of introducing something wonderful to someone else. And if you're the person who's going to go first, then you can also know this, that you've given them a gift that will last for all of their life. And when you think about people that you've lost yourself, and until you have lost someone, you can only understand so much intellectually about what that's like. You have to experience things viscerally in some areas of life, truly to understand them. But when you're the one who's left, you can carry on feeling really, really close to that loved one by doing that thing which you shared together. And it might be painful at first. You might feel you don't want to do it because it won't be the same because they're not there. And now they're not there, you don't want to do it at all. And that's entirely your prerogative. I'm not telling you that there's a right or a wrong answer to that. But I would urge you to consider carrying on doing the thing. I'd ask you to consider carrying on doing it. Because far from making you miss your loved one even more, I think you might find that it makes you feel even closer to them. Of all the money that ever I spent, well, I spent it in good company, and all the harm that ever I've done, well, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done, for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass. Good night and joy be with you all. And all the comrades that ever I had, they are sorry for my going away. And all the sweethearts that e'er I had, they would wish me one more day to stay. But since it falls unto my lot that I should rise, and you should not, I'll gently rise and softly fall. Good night and joy be with you all. You are listening to Eclectic Waffle. Please join us next time. And please, 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 please listen to some old episodes as well. Thank you.